think have great impact and effect on our tribal court system.
The state takes steps towards working with tribes on tribal justice. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 31st. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, testing research drones in the Bering Sea.
Getting to the Arctic to measure how fast the ice is melting and what happens to the ocean when it does melt is huge. So we can send these at very low risk and very low cost into some of the harshest parts of the planet.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Arctic drilling is underway. Shell Oil confirmed Thursday night that its Polar Pioneer rig sent a drill bit spinning into the floor of the Chukchi Sea about 5 p.m. Alaska time. It came at the end of one of the most eventful days in the company's 8-year effort to find oil in the Arctic Ocean. More than 2,000 miles away, just a few minutes before the drill bit hit the seafloor, the company's icebreaker, Fenica, managed to free itself from a blockade of protesters in Portland, Oregon. Shell has begun drilling a 40-foot-deep cellar for housing a blowout preventer. It can only begin drilling into oil-bearing layers beneath the seafloor after the Fenica arrives at the drill site in the Chukchi Sea. Interior Department officials say they expect to approve the deeper drilling quickly once the Fenica has returned to the Arctic. Alaska's Attorney General announced in an opinion issued yesterday, law enforcement must uphold tribal protection orders the same as it does state protective orders, regardless of whether the order's been registered with the state. The Attorney General also encouraged the legislature to amend Alaska law to bring it into compliance with the Violence Against Women Act. KTOO's Jennifer Canfield has more.
Attorney General Craig Richards says the Violence Against Women Act clearly supersedes Alaska's conflicting law requiring registration of tribal court and so-called foreign protection orders. The opinion basically affirms VAWA's provision that tribal court and out-of-state protective orders need not be registered with the state in order to be enforced, a provision with which the Parnell administration refused to comply.
Well, I'm very excited to see this. I think it's a step in the right direction in rural tribal justice.
That's President of the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Tribes of Alaska, Richard Peterson.
It's going to really, I think, have great impact and effect on our tribal court system.
Peterson says Tlingit and Haida is looking forward to more positive action from the Walker administration on tribal issues such as land into trust and transboundary mining. Nick Gaska, Associate Counsel for the Tanana Chiefs Conference based in Fairbanks, also says that the opinion is an indication of the thawing relationship between the state and Alaska tribes.
This, again, no doubt reflects his position that with applicable law, instead of fighting tribes at every case, despite the fact that, you know, law says otherwise, at least in this VAWA case, that he's moving forward to correct the department's previous positions and reconcile relationships with tribes.
The provision in VAWA requiring states to honor protective orders issued by other states and tribes was included when the act was first passed in 1994. When Congress reauthorized the act in 2013, a disagreement between the state and the Department of Justice regarding the validity of unregistered protective orders intensified. In a December 2013 letter to Indian Law and Order Commission Chairman Troy Ide, then Attorney General Michael Garrity said that while tribal court protective orders must be registered with the state to be enforceable, Alaska state troopers could, without the formality of state court registration, choose to enforce the order if confronted with an emergency or tense situation. After a June 2014 meeting with Tony West, then an associate attorney general with the Department of Justice, Garrity sent a follow-up letter listing things the federal government could do to help address public safety issues affecting Alaska Natives and Native youth. The letter requested more funding for tribal courts, prevention efforts, and support for village public safety officers, among other things. About a month later, West responded to Garrity's letter and acknowledged his suggestions, but focused on how Alaska's law requiring registration of tribal protective orders was directly in contradiction to federal law. West offered to discuss with Garrity ways to bring Alaska into compliance with federal law and offered training on the provisions of VAWA. Jacqueline Schaefer, an assistant attorney general with the state of Alaska, says one of the nice things about the opinion is that it doesn't address the sticky issue of tribal jurisdiction. The opinion also makes clear that officers can enforce orders that are clearly intended to be protective orders, even if they are not explicitly labeled as such.
It's really just saying that, you know, as long as the order is clear that, you know, the issuing court says that they had jurisdiction and that they provided due process and that the order meets the requirements of VAWA, then the officer will enforce that order on the ground. It doesn't matter if the order has been registered or not.
Schaefer says there is no set protocol for a situation in which a victim claims to have a tribal protection order but doesn't have a copy of it and hasn't registered it with the state. She says she could imagine the officer simply contacting the tribal court in that case, to ensure that the order exists.
And so that would be an easy resolution, but it would be most protective of the victim to have the order registered with the state court. And it's a fairly simple process. You just fax the order to the state court.
The opinion also says that orders must meet the requirements of VAWA in order to be valid. One condition is that the person that the order is issued against must be provided due process. The opinion also points out, however, that the U.S. Supreme Court has indicated a tribal court's obligation to provide due process does not mean that tribal courts must use the same procedures as state or federal courts. What constitutes due process could be a point of contention for someone who wants to challenge a protective order issued against them by a tribal court. But Schaefer says this is also an area of the law that is yet to be determined. In Juneau, I'm Jennifer Canfield.
Alaska state troopers say one person is dead and numerous others injured in a highway crash involving at least 7 vehicles, including a tour bus. Troopers say the crash occurred earlier today on the Seward Highway in the Portage area south of Anchorage. Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters says she doesn't know how many people have been sent to the hospital other than 3 people in critical condition. Anchorage police say the highway in the Portage area is expected to remain closed for several hours. The 15-year-old survivor of a plane crash near Juneau was recognized by the U.S. Coast Guard yesterday for helping to save the other 3 passengers despite his own injuries. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Jose Vasquez was on the wings of Alaska Cessna that crashed into a mountain 18 miles west of Juneau, killing the pilot. Vasquez lives in Puerto Rico and was in Juneau visiting his godparents. All 3 and another passenger were traveling to Hoonah. Coast Guard spokesman Grant DeVoist says Vasquez used survival skills he learned as a Boy Scout.
He had multiple injuries, but he still went through many steps to make sure the other passengers got the help they needed.
Vasquez had broken ribs and a collapsed lung, according to his godfather. Vasquez put layers of clothing around his godmother, Sandra Herrera Lopez, to preserve body heat. He lifted cargo boxes that had fallen on another passenger, Ernestine Hanlon Abel of Hoonah. DeVoist says Vasquez then found 3 cell phones and called 911. He used a phone app to determine the latitude and longitude of the crash site and passed them on to emergency operators.
When he heard one of the first helicopters from Temsco nearby, he started using smoke signals. And then later when the Coast Guard helicopter arrived on scene, he started waving a silver thermal blanket to attract attention, and that successfully vectored them in for what was the rescue of the passengers.
DeVoist says Vasquez's efforts accelerated the search and rescue.
There was the emergency beacon aboard the aircraft, but without his precise location, because of how heavily wooded everything was, it would have taken longer for the rescue crews to locate them.
The Coast Guard honored Vasquez during a ceremony closed to the media at Juneau's federal building. DeVoist says about 50 people were there, including family and friends and Coast Guard personnel. His godfather, Humberto Hernandez, another passenger on the flight, is a Coast Guard doctor. Hernandez says he's getting physical therapy. He has a swollen leg, back pain, and will have to have some teeth removed. Wife Sandra Herrera Lopez had been medevaced to Harborview Medical Center in Seattle. He says she had several fractures to the head, arm, ankle, collarbone, and ribs. She's since been transferred to another hospital in Seattle. Hoonah resident Ernestine Hanlon Abel is still at Harborview. Her husband, Tom Abel, says she's undergone multiple operations and has both legs in casts. He hopes she'll be able to leave the hospital soon, but will likely stay in an assisted living facility before returning to Hoonah. Vasquez is awaiting clearance from his doctor before going home to Puerto Rico. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a lighthouse and whale research station near Petersburg looks for funding from, what else, cruise ship tourists.
This is how we funded our replacement hydrophone after it got taken by a sea lion. It's actually really important for us. The more the merrier.
That's ahead.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
A stronger-than-expected run of Yukon River Chinook salmon is allowing fishery managers to loosen subsistence harvest restrictions on both the U.S. and Canadian sides of the river. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the better-than-anticipated run is still small by historical standards, but may signal that Yukon king stocks are beginning to rebound.
Nearly 65,000 kings had passed the state's sonar counter near the U.S.-Canada border at Eagle as of Wednesday, enough to exceed key milestones, according to Alaska Department of Fish and Game biologist Stephanie Schmidt.
This number is above the upper end of our escapement objective, which is 42,500 to 55,000. And we also believe that we've passed enough Chinook salmon across the border to meet the harvest sharing agreements that are outlined in the treaty with Canada.
The harvest sharing agreement divides the number of kings in excess of the escapement goal between Alaska and Canadian fishermen.
Not much we can do retroactively here, unfortunately, but we have started to ease up on the fishing restrictions where Chinook salmon are still moving through in the Alaska portion of the drainage. Includes the communities of Stevens Village, Beaver, Fort Yukon, Circle, and Eagle.
Schmidt says there's already been some king harvests by Alaska subsistence fishermen, including a reported 3,000 incidentally caught in the commercial summer chum fishery. She expects a similar conservative catch in Canada.
Many First Nations are maintaining a moratorium on fishing to protect and conserve Chinook salmon and get every fish on the spawning grounds that they can.
This year's return is the second in a row that appears to show some movement toward rebuilding a run that once totaled 300,000 but has struggled for the past two decades due to overharvest and suspected environmental factors. Beyond the raw return number, Schmidt says this summer's Yukon King run also showed another positive sign.
About 44% of the fish that have gone by that sonar project at the border have been females. The highest number of females that we've sent onto the spawning grounds since 2003 and is the fourth highest since 1982.
She says a salmon research project near the river mouth is seeing more juvenile Chinook than in past years, a potential sign of bigger runs to come, depending on environmental conditions. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Aquatic robots have been spotted in the Aleutian Islands. Two ocean-going drones were seen sailing into Dutch Harbor Monday night with no one on board. KUCB's John Ryan has the story.
These robots are 18 feet tall. Each one has a bright orange wing of carbon fiber sticking up from a floating platform. At sea, they look like oversized windsurfers. Using the wind for propulsion and solar panels for their electronics, they've been traveling thousands of miles in the Bering Sea all by themselves. It's almost like they have minds of their own. But these robots are working for good, not evil, we think. Richard Jenkins is their creator. He's the CEO of Sail Drone Inc. in California.
They're autonomous. You send them waypoints in a corridor and it won't venture out of that corridor, regardless of wind or tide. So it's kind of self-controlling and you just need a human to tell them roughly where to go.
Self-controlling. Not sure I like the sound of that. Jenkins came up to Unalaska to take his robots out of the water and send them home after a three-month science mission.
On the mast there, that little square thing pointing down, that is a laser, so it's an infrared, infrared camera, you could say. What it does, it tells you the sea surface temperature, the very top micron of the water.
Great. Robots with lasers. What could possibly go wrong? If these self-controlling machines haven't gone rogue, they've been using their instruments to measure temperature, acidity, and 20 other conditions in the rapidly changing Bering Sea. Scientists with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and the University of Washington are collaborating on the high-tech project. They say each drone can carry more than 200 pounds of scientific instruments. They can cruise the ocean at up to 14 knots. They can boldly go where it would cost a lot more to send a ship full of human beings. At a busy fishing dock on Unalaska's Captain's Bay, Jenkins says he launched the two sail drones from the very same dock in April.
We sent them out of here into 45 knot headwinds, and from here they went to St. Paul, and then up to the Bering Sea, went to Nome, then over to the Norton Sound. We mapped the Yukon Delta, and they sailed back to Dutch Harbor, so 4,500 miles on each drone.
The last time humans surveyed the seafloor of the Yukon Delta, the year was 1899. Scientists hope new data from the drones can further human understanding of problems threatening Bering Sea fisheries. Problems like climate change, retreating sea ice, and ocean acidification. Problems that humans, not robots, have caused. Who's more intelligent, your drones or you?
Drones for sure.
Why do you say that?
No, the drones aren't intelligent. The drones are robots that follow simple rules. They're not able to make decisions for themselves. That's all done back at base. You don't want to have a whole heap of computing power on the drones because, you know, it's a low-power device. You only get so much energy from the sun, and computing power equals power consumption. And this is just a pretty simple brain that actually just gets it from A to B and takes measurements.
I guess that's reassuring. NOAA scientists say the drone's biggest challenge isn't subjugating the human race to their will, but dealing with cold water, limited sunlight, and jellyfish. Large numbers of jellyfish can clog the drone's water intakes. Isn't that like War of the Worlds, where the attacking aliens were felled by bacteria? Jenkins says his creations handled the jellyfish and algae and storms of the Bering Sea beautifully.
If these vehicles can survive the Bering Sea, they can survive any place on Earth.
Great. So if the drones do rise up against their masters, there's no place to hide. Next year, scientists hope to send the drones beyond the Bering Strait and into the Arctic Ocean. Here's Dr. Strange drone. I mean, Richard Jenkins again.
The Arctic is one of the sort of the cutting edges of climate change right now, so getting to the Arctic to measure how fast the ice is melting and what happens to the ocean when it does melt is huge. So normally that would be very, very expensive. You'd need a big icebreaker, and it's a long way to go and very remote. Whereas we can send these at very low risk and very low cost into some of the harshest parts of the planet.
But what if the drones get sick of being sent to the harshest parts of the planet?
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Of course, that's just science fiction.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
In science nonfiction, Jenkins disassembles his sail drones on the busy fishing dock. He straps them down into their shipping crates, and they don't seem to put up any resistance. Maybe they are just useful tools for gathering important data about our rapidly changing oceans. Maybe. In Unalaska, I'm John Ryan.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue,
Dillingham, Sitka, Chugiak,
Fairbanks, Fort Yukon, Wrangell,
Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Monica Goki. This week on AK, Lighthouse Living.
For most of the summer, the three people who live in Five Finger Lighthouse only have each other and the local wildlife for company. They look after the lighthouse and do research on the humpback whales that surround the island. But that costs money, so for the first time this year, they invited a cruise ship laden with yoga-loving tourists to ferry its passengers onto their rocky shores. KFSK's Joe Sykes recently witnessed the tourist takeover and filed this story.
Five Finger Lighthouse sits on an island so small, the humans, animals, and birds live in a kind of reluctant harmony.
Everybody knows everybody else. You know, the crows and the eagles and the marine mammals, we all get along and put up with each other.
Paul Sharp is the lighthouse keeper for the 2015 summer season. His two other human companions on the island are his brother Fred, who heads up the Alaska Whale Foundation, and Fred's intern Dawn, who's studying humpbacks for her senior thesis. Sharp lives most of the year in eastern Washington, but recently became an empty nester and decided he wanted to spend his summers somewhere a little different. But while he's proud to be known as lighthouse keeper, he says actually the term is a bit of a relic.
Because really, we take care of everything but the light.
The Coast Guard maintains the light, but the everything else Sharp is talking about means his home for the summer. The view from here is all rainforest-covered mountains, snowy peaks, and wild seas. But the lighthouse itself is something of the more homey variety.
Okay, so this is our main living area. We have the galley, the kitchen area, and this has come back a long ways from what it used to look like.
That's because with money raised by the Juneau Lighthouse Association, a non-profit that fundraises for the island, and a bit of love and care, people like Paul Sharp have made this into a home. Bottles of wine are laid out on the counter, wooden snowshoes hang down from the ceiling, and old pictures of suitably bearded former lighthouse keepers adorn the wall. But keeping a place like this livable and accessible is difficult. So Sharp is looking for ways for the lighthouse to reinvent itself. And today, the reinvention begins.
We're gonna do the landing.
Roger that. Right now the east side looks like you could maybe land there. You'd have to clamber over the rocks a bit. There's also the south part of the island.
The tourists are coming.
Okay. Woo! I got the water in the...
There are about 70 of them, replete with sun visors, backpacks, and yoga mats. The island's never had this many visitors on it before. One of the reasons is it's not easy to access. The cruisers have to clamber across hidden rocks while the skiff captain negotiates the rising tide.
You guys want to see the bald eagle's nest and take the trail towards the lighthouse?
Yeah.
Follow me. Okay, bald eagle coming in, you guys.
A couple of those cruisers have come all the way from the Berkshires in Massachusetts. Joel Grossman helps his wife Judy take her shoe off after she slipped getting off the boat.
You know what?
You want to take your sock off?
Because wool, I think, is good. Would you help me?
We'll just push
it.
She might have got her foot wet, but she isn't fazed.
It's fascinating, and I'm not a young chick. And to be able
to
do this...
She's a chick. She's just not young.
I thought, I'm not going to be able to do it. But then I decided I wanted to do it, and I'm doing it. So it's on my bucket list.
They head into the lighthouse, which is now teeming with people. There are sweatshirts and postcards laid out on the table. Paul Sharp's even turned into a businessman flogging souvenirs.
Just sold a t-shirt, actually, yeah.
But it's not just the shop that's causing excitement. Through a door at the back of the lighthouse, the tourists wind up a steep stone spiral staircase until they reach the light that still warns ships off the island's forbidding rocks. Judy Grossman's granddaughter, Lily, is an 11-year-old New Yorker who's just made the trek up to the top of the light.
I don't think I would want to go up those stairs every day.
Do you have an elevator in your building in New York?
Yeah, we have four. I barely ever climb the stairs.
Both the tourists and the lighthouse are trying out something new. And Paul Sharp says in the long run, this is how this place and the whale research that goes on here will survive.
This is how we funded our replacement hydrophone after it got taken by a sea lion. It's actually really important for us.
The more the merrier.
You know, in a couple hours they'll all be gone and it'll be really quiet here and we'll be all by ourselves.
For now though, they're still here. And let's face it, the only way to wind down after a few hours on a craggy outpost in the middle of Frederick Sound is...
Welcome to yoga at Five Fingers Lighthouse. How cool is this?
With a mass yoga session on top of the concrete helipad.
So everyone comes to the front of their mats, feet hip width apart. Let's close our eyes And just take a few deep breaths, connecting your breath, thinking about your breath.
In Petersburg, I'm Joe Sykes.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're talking to Albert Gamboa, who was fishing on the banks of Ship Creek in downtown Anchorage. He's originally from the Philippines and has lived in Anchorage on and off since 1989.
I'm a person who loves outdoors, especially in the summertime. I usually go hunt, fish, camping and everything. Yeah, I'm an outdoor man. Yeah. One thing that's why I went back to Alaska is the fishing. I love the place, yeah. Although it's kind of brutal in winter time sometimes, but you don't have to stay outside, you know, in winter time. But it's still good though, yeah. First time I went fishing in Ship Creek, that was probably 1989. I was just watching in here, saw people catching fish. And then I asked one guy and asked him how to do it. And then the guy asked me if I have a pole. I said no. He borrowed me one of his pole. I was fishing right on that corner in there. I thought my line would get snagged. And then I got a king, a big one. Yeah, that's my first fishing. And ever since then, I started fishing in Ship Creek. And then that's it. That's all it started. And then I met a lot of people. I met a lot of friends. Leave them, went back in here, see them again, be friends with them again. That's a good thing. I love Alaska. Yeah. It's like this is the place where all the stress from work, when I'm in Ship Creek, everything's something like it's a serene place for me. It's you see your friend, something like that. It's good place. Yeah.
Albert Gamboa fishes Ship Creek in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to tell your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Joe Sykes, Annie Fite, and Ann Hillman. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Monica Goki.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from John Ryan in Unalaska, Jennifer Canfield and Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Baby salmon live here, right in our backyards and neighborhoods. Go out, explore, and take the Baby Salmon Challenge. For more information, go to babysalmon.fish. This announcement is sponsored by the Salmon Project. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.